ABC News anchor Dan Harris has been on assignments that range from presidential elections to human trafficking. He's even had a run-in with wild elephants. But Harris says his most challenging assignment by far was much more personal, finding a way to tame the voice inside his head. Dan Harris joins today to tell the intimate story of his journey to not only tame that voice, but find greater happiness and peace of mind. His journey took him from the bright lights of TV studios to the fringes of self-help and the front line of neuroscience to come away with a simple way to calm his mind and be at least 10% happier every day. Dan Harris's new book is 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. He shares what he's learned now. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Let's jump in with that voice in your head. The original title of your book, I can't say on the air, but it was, I'll paraphrase, my inner voice is a jerk. What was your inner voice and what kind of things was it telling you, that inner narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a universal thing. We all have an inner narrator that is really the central feature of our lives. It is what we take to be us, the self. And most of us are so entranced by the nonstop conversation we're having with ourselves that we're unaware of this inner narrator, but it's the thing that has us constantly projecting into the future or remembering the past instead of being focused on whatever's happening right now. It's a sort of a jumble of urges and desires that has you reaching in the fridge when you're not hungry, or you know, checking your email when you're supposed to be talking to your kid. And having that pointed out to me was very powerful, and then finding a way to fix it was even more powerful.
We'll get into to fix it, but I want to lead you through how you got into trouble where felt like you needed fixing. You were in a pretty high stress line of work, network journalism, not mellow like us here at Public Radio. and that inner voice was a driver. You saw it as a positive in some ways, even though it sometimes went in negative directions. Where was it steering you wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that it can be positive. It can be what drives us. It can to drive us to succeed. It can drive us to be generous or funny or insightful. But it can also, if you're unaware of it, be a tricky puppeteer. In my case, I made a series of bad decisions that sort of began with my arrival here at ABC News when I was 28 years old. And I looked like I was barely post-pubescent, and I was working with these giants like Diane Sawyer and Peter Jennings and Ted Koppel, and I was green and aware of it and insecure about it. And so I made this decision to be a workaholic, and I threw myself into it. And after 9/11, I went to war zones across the Middle East and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of did so without really thinking about the psychological ramifications. And when I came home from that, after doing that for several years, I got depressed, crashed and burned a little bit, and then did another really dumb thing, which was I self-medicated for a brief period of time with recreational drugs. And even though I wasn't doing that when I was at work, definitely not when I was on the air, I later learned from my doctor that it raises the level of adrenaline in the brain, which is most likely what led to my having a panic attack on national television.
That's the nightmare for a person in journalism. You're on the air nationally and you have a panic attack.
Exactly. I mean, I was anchoring a Good Morning America, and I was halfway through a brief news update, and I just lost the ability to breathe. I couldn't breathe. My heart was racing. I just couldn't think straight anymore, and I had to bail right in the middle, and it was the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me.
So now you're thinking, I got to help myself, but then there's this self-help movement. You felt, I'm going to understate it here, a bit skeptical about the self-help movement.
Yeah, I still think self-help is largely ridiculous. And the idea that you can solve all of your problems through the power of positive thinking is, I believe, demonstratively baloney. And but I found myself gravitating towards some of the more interesting parts of self-help, like this guy Eckhart Tolle, who was the first person I'd ever heard talk about the voice in the head. And so there were some parts of self-help that I thought was interesting, but also a lot of it was really off-putting. And ultimately, after sort of marinating in this strange little American subculture for a while, I got turned on to the last thing I ever thought would be useful, which is meditation.
And what did you think of meditation before you gave it a shot?
As you can tell, I'm a pretty skeptical guy. I thought meditation was uniquely ridiculous for you know, hippies and gurus and people who live in a yurt or, you know, collect crystals or just not me, basically, you know, fans of Enya and John Tesh. And I was not going to go there. But then I heard about the science, and the science is incredible.
Bonus points for use of yurt there. What is it that got you making the first step and saying, okay, I'm going to swallow the skepticism for a little bit and actually try meditating?
It was when I was confronted with this is a sheer volume of science that says that that meditation is it can do pretty incredible things for your brain and your body. You know, it's been shown to reduce your blood pressure, boost your immune system, and a whole range of positive effects on ailments and both physical and psychological. But the real amazing stuff is the brain science, which a lot of which is being done in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
By Dr. Richie Davidson, who's a friend of mine, and it's been shown to thicken the gray matter, literally make your gray matter thicker in areas associated with self-awareness and compassion, and reduce the gray matter in an area associated with stress. And so this is why it's now being done by a whole elite subculture of very successful and impressive people, from the U.S. Marines to the U.S. Army to corporate executives to doctors, lawyers, school children, and even fidgety, skeptical news anchors.
Well, the only time I've ever meditated was with Richie Davidson sitting in the chair next to me teaching us how to meditate on the air. I had one of the same reservations that you expressed before you tried it, that you're not the kind of person, that I'm not the kind of person who could sit still and do nothing for a period of time.
But the thing is, first of all, sitting still is it's tricky still for me to this day, and I've been doing it for a long time. But you're not doing nothing, as a matter of fact. It's rigorous brain exercise, trying to wrestle the mind to the ground. It's like holding a live fish in your hands. It's really hard. But so is exercise. If you go to the gym and you're on the treadmill and you're doing it right, it's going to be difficult. That's the same thing with meditation. You got to think about it just like exercise for your brain. Every time, it's basically a focusing exercise. And every time you lose your focus and then return back to your point of focus, it's like doing a bicep curl for your brain. And you're breaking a lifetime of habit of walking around in a fog of memory or fantasy and actually focusing on what's happening right now. And it's beneficial in a whole bunch of ways.
Well, getting back to taming that voice in your head, that inner narrative we were talking about earlier, how did studying meditation, and I guess more to the point, practicing meditation, help you rein in that inner voice?
The first thing is the learning to focus when you're, to use a lack of a cliche, a less cliched term, when you're in the moment, when you're paying attention to what's happening right now, the inner narrator is in a lot less control. You're not casting off into some imagined future or remembering some idealized past. You're actually right here, right now. And so you're not getting yanked around as much. And so the ability, the muscle, building up the muscle to just pay attention is a huge way to defang the voice in the head. But really, the superpower that comes over time is the ability to see what's going on in your mind at any given moment, to notice anger, for example, without getting carried away by it. So let me just give you a quick example. You're online at Starbucks. Somebody cuts you off. You think to yourself, I'm angry. You then reflexively, immediately, and automatically inhabit the thought. You actually become angry. With mindfulness, with meditation, you actually learn to see the anger coming up in your head, or maybe the buzzing in your chest, your ears getting red, and you notice what's happening, but you don't actually have to take the bait and get carried away by it. That's amazing. I mean, think about how many times we lose our temper and regret it later. Think of any high-stress meetings we're in where it would have been nice to be the calmest person in the room. Think about how many times we eat when we're not actually hungry. If you can short-circuit this habitual behavior, it's a huge, huge advantage.
How long did it take to develop that? Was it overnight? You started meditating. All of a sudden, you had that meta ability to notice that you're angry and deal with it?
It took me a while, and I'm not perfect. I mean, there's a reason why I call the book 10% Happier. Mm-hmm. If we had my wife on the line right now, she could give you an hour-long interview on the ways in which I am imperfect. So I am not claiming that I became the Dalai Lama overnight. However, change did happen very quickly, and I would tell your listeners, give it 5 minutes a day for a couple of weeks, and if you don't find yourself feeling calmer, better at being present and focused on whatever's happening at any given moment, and a little bit more aware of what's actually happening in your skull, send me a note on Twitter and tell me I'm an idiot. But I don't think you'll be sending that note, because I actually think 5 minutes a day will make a significant difference.
Listening to a conversation we had with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and author of the book 10% Happier. You can share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. We continue the conversation we had with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News Nightline and co-anchor for the Met Weekend edition of Good Morning America. His book is called 10% Happier. He says happiness can come from meditation, actually. It's about how he dealt with stress and a panic attack on the air. By turning to meditation, he says he found himself, give or take, 10% happier. Dan, I want to talk about the 10% thing. As you mentioned earlier, you were and still are skeptical of self-help because of a lot of over-promising. Why is that the case? Why is there so much of that out there?
It sells books, and people like the idea of a miracle cure. It's attractive. But I think we're ready in America for a more realistic discussion. I think people have been burned enough times being sold a bill of goods that they can fix everything in their life in one fell swoop. And for me, the answer, 10% happier, that I started saying that when my skeptical friends would ask me, why are you meditating? What's happened to you? And I found myself saying, oh, you know, because it makes me 10% happier. And I would notice when I said that, that the looks of scorn on the faces of my friends would transform into something more like interest and envy, because, you know, 10% is a pretty good return on investment, and it sounds reasonable. So I just named the book that.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Guy on the line in West Allis. Guy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering, when do you find is the best time to meditate? Because I know right now I'm potentially going through a job layoff, and it's like I'm stressed a lot of the time, and it's like, you know, do I do it right away in the morning? Would that help all day? Or do I have to try to find time at work where I can get away from everybody and do it there, but then you're supposed to be at work, and it's like, when's the best time to do it?
I don't think first of all, thanks for the question. I appreciate it. I don't think you have to be overly neurotic or militant about it. I think you should do it whenever's best for you. Personally, my schedule is crazy, so I just fit it in when I can. You don't want to make it something that's just another stressor in your life. It should be fit in a time when you can, but every day is different. And so I try to do 30 minutes a day. That's just because I find it really beneficial. But there are days when things are super crazy, like they were yesterday, for example, and I only did 10. So give yourself a break, but there's something about the dailiness of it that can make a huge difference, because it's that daily confrontation with the craziness of your own mind that allows you, when your mind is being crazy in real life, to recognize, oh, I don't have to take this so seriously.
But don't stress out because you can't find that full half hour to fit in.
Correct. Okay. And by the way, I do a half hour, but I'm writing a book about this. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying everybody needs to do a half hour. I believe that 5 minutes is enough, especially for a starter.
Guy, thanks for the question and good luck with your job situation.
Yeah.
We'll go now to Kurt in Evansville. Kurt, hi.
Hi. I'm listening to this and I'm wondering, is there much of a difference between prayer and meditation? And if there is, what would that difference be?
You know, it depends on the prayer and it depends on the meditation, and from a neurological standpoint. So there have been studies that look at what prayer does to the brain, as well as all these studies about what meditation does to the brain. And I'm not an expert on the prayer piece of this, but I believe there's some commonalities. And I have some evangelical friends who, a pastor friend of mine who does this practice where he walks around and tries to see the world through Jesus's eyes, and so in a much more compassionate way, and it, just in his view of passersby on the street. That's not entirely dissimilar to a type of meditation known as compassion meditation. What I think is radical about both of these is that you're actually training your brain to be more empathetic and more compassionate. It shows up on the brain scans when you do compassion meditation. What a radical notion that we aren't stuck with our perceived level of compassion from birth. It's actually a muscle we can train. Think about if we start teaching kids how to do this. what that would do for bullying, or never mind the future of the planet. So and meditation is the same thing. It basically is saying you're not stuck with your level of happiness just based on the quality of your childhood or your employment situation or whether you've won the lottery recently. It's a skill that can be trained. To me, that is such a radical and interesting notion.
And not just happiness. I think you make the point in there that we don't have to take any of our basic personality traits or maybe flaws for granted.
It's all part of a story we tell ourselves. We are this kind of person. I'm a shy person, or I'm a loner, or I'm irritable, et cetera, as if these are fixed things that can never, ever be changed. But I think they can be changed. I'm not talking about some radical overnight transformation into, a golden retriever. I'm just saying that around the edges, you can recognize that this is a story you're telling yourself that in any given moment isn't necessarily true. And with meditation, you can get much better at not taking these habitual, lifelong, and often debilitating stories so seriously.
Back to our callers now with Dawn in Waukesha. Dawn, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, my question is, I was telling the person who answered the phone, type AAA you're talking to right now, going from 5 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night. How do you slow down? How do you actually meditate? I mean, I'm an educated person, but how do you meditate? What do you mean when you say meditate? You sit there on a pillow? What do you do?
You want me to give you a quick 30-second lesson?
101. Go for it, Dan. Yeah.
All right, let's do this. The other day, for a New York Times technology reporter, I gave him a meditation lesson in fewer characters than it takes to send a tweet. But I'm going to give you a slightly longer version, Don. With the caveat that the word meditation is kind of like the word sports. It can describe a whole range of activities, but I'm talking about a meditation called mindfulness, which is completely secular, nothing to join, no fees to pay, nothing to believe or anything like that. It's just a form of exercise for your brain. So here's what it involves. Sit down. You can actually do it standing up or lying down, but traditionally you just sit down. You don't have to be cross-legged. You can be in a chair. It's important to have your spine straight just because you don't want to fall asleep if you're too slouched. Close your eyes. And then pick a spot where you feel your breath most prominently, like your nose, your chest, your belly. And you don't have to breathe in any special way. Just notice what it feels like when the breath comes in and when the breath goes out. There's nothing special about the breath. It's just a good thing to focus on because we're always breathing as long as we're alive. And then every time your mind wanders, which it will a million times, whether you're AAA personality or not, your mind is going to wander to crazy things like, what did I have for lunch? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss, et cetera, et cetera. Every time your mind wanders, just forgive yourself and bring your attention back to your breath. And it's rigorous. It's a rigorous brain exercise. It's very tough to do. But every time you catch yourself, that's a bicep curl for your brain. You are breaking a lifetime of habit of just being lost in this thought that defines our life. Instead, you're just focusing on what's happening right now, which in this case is your breath.
Don, give it a shot and good luck. Dan, one thing you were worried about is maybe if you solve some of the problems with the voice in your head, you might lose your edge and you're in an industry where maybe it's taken for granted. You're going to be hot-tempered, high stress, and that's just part of the gig.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a widespread cultural assumption that in order to be successful, you have to be somewhat miserable. In order to be Van Gogh, you need to cut your ear off. But I'm not sure that's true. In fact, I found that the less the not being a hostage to the noise in my brain, the noise that we all have going on in our mind at any given moment, has made me a better, more efficient, effective decision maker, a better colleague, a better listener, more efficient at doing the work I need to do at any given moment. And this is why you're seeing such spectacularly successful people like the co-founder of Twitter, Phil Jackson, the basketball coach, the U.S. Marines, the U.S. Army, rock stars, et cetera, now adopting this practice because it is you can see the decreased mental noise and the increased efficiency.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it's a total pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was a conversation we had with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and co-anchor for the weekend edition of Good Morning America. He's author of the book 10% Happier.